This is how we overcome. We're moving on, kick it down. Reaching to the world, arms open, yeah. This is how we practice great. Welcome back to Crazy Faith Talk. I'm Steve.
I'm Erica.
And we are here still in these 12 days of Christmas, so still a Merry Christmas to you. We are part of that time that the timekeeping church calls, as I said, the 12 days of Christmas, celebrating Jesus' birth and different angles of the story of Jesus' birth and the meaning of what we sometimes call the incarnation, the idea of God being one among us in a human life in Jesus. So here we are in this season. We spent a good bit of time in our last episode, Erica, talking about the famous nativity story from Luke's gospel. But as we've noted multiple times, anybody with a Bible knows there are four different gospel stories. Maybe it would be good for us to spend a little bit of time with another one of them. Would you be willing for us to spend a little bit of time in Matthew with Matthew's nativity scene?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, so, all right, I'm ready. I'm getting sentimental. I'm sort of buckled in for another homespun Charlie Brown Christmassy. Give us the nativity according to Matthew.
She bore him a son, and he named him Jesus.
That's
it. that's all.
That's it. That's Matthew's version. Huh?
That's so Matthew.
There it is. You turn to Matthew chapter 1, and if you're talking about an actual story of Jesus' birth, what you get is she had a son, named him Jesus. And then you move on to a story that we do know.
Yes.
The story about the visitation of the Magi, or sometimes called the visitation of the wise men. And there is a story that people know. There's a story we have figurines for that go in our nativity scenes, right? Okay, so maybe give us a little bit of that story, Erica.
Okay, well, let's try to go a little bit further here. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem asking, "Where is the child who has been born King of the Jews? For we observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all of Jerusalem with him. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it was written by the prophet, 'And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least amongst the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel.' Then Herod secretly called for the wise men and learned from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go, search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word, so they might go and pay homage.' When they heard the king, they set out, and there ahead of them went the star that they had seen at its rising, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw that star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another road."
Okay, well, there's a lot going on in there.
Yes.
Are there things in particular that jump out at you as places for conversation, or things that poke at you when you hear this story?
Well, as we talked in the last episode about, you know, the good news of the birth of the Messiah, and we talked about Herod a little bit, and how Herod was a very jealous and very fearful king.
Yeah.
We get a little bit of that in this section.
Yeah.
We get a little bit more as we continue the story on.
He gets worse. He doesn't get any better.
No, he gets much worse.
He goes full Disney villain almost.
Yes. Yes, indeed. You know, Herod hears about this new king, and being the jealous and fearful king that he is, he wants to know, like, okay, who is this person that's trying to take over my throne? And as we continue into Matthew 2, we get kind of a bit of a throwback to what we were saying in our last episode to the Egypt story and the exile story, because Herod eventually, because he's found out that, you know, the star appeared about 2 years ago and the wise men have been traveling this time, he goes out all full Disney villain and kills all the boys in Bethlehem under the age of two.
In a way that echoes that move of King Pharaoh in Egypt, you know, over all the Hebrew children. Right? And again, it's not that we're saying that Matthew made up these details because, oh, well, let me make up a connection between Pharaoh and Jesus, but that Matthew's trying to highlight these parallels as if to say that Jesus sort of stands in continuity with Moses, and just like these things happen in the Moses story, there are these echoes there. So that part of Matthew's bigger project is to help his primarily Jewish audience probably see that Jesus sort of stands in continuity with the great lawgiver Moses. So we're going to see lots of parallels if you read through all of Matthew's gospel between Jesus and Moses, and, mm-hmm. and this is one of those details, one of those scenes. But it also seems to be setting up the tension between the way the world uses power and the way Jesus and the God that Jesus reveals use power. That Herod, in some ways, is perfectly savvy if he's a character on Game of Thrones. I mean, like, this is the smart Machiavellian, you know, thing to do, is eliminate any threats that are out there. Mm-hmm. So if there's anybody you're suspicious of, wipe them all out, problem solved, and, you know, get rid of your enemies before they become powerful. That's, you know, world ruling 101 by the way the world does things. Mm-hmm. So what the contrast maybe is that that's not the God we meet in Jesus. The God we meet in Jesus does things very differently. And instead of wiping out those who are threats to him, gets crucified by his threats, by those who are powerful or his enemies. But some of that tension of the difference between how God rules, how God reigns, and how the way mm-hmm. the world operates is there, even in sort of a kernel form here.
And another throwback to the Egypt story is that, you know, the way Jesus escapes all this.
Right.
Is that his family flees actually to Egypt?
Yeah.
And then he's called. And then eventually, once Herod has died, they are able to come back. You know, an angel appears to Joseph and says it's safe for him to go back.
Yeah,
and we get this line: "Out of Egypt, I have called my son."
Yeah, so there's a number of layers of things going mm-hmm. on there in that part of the story. And again, most people know the Magi. Maybe slightly less familiar is, after the Magi disappear, Herod gets angry and is starting to kill babies, so...
Well, who wants to talk about that?
Right, yeah. I mean, there's certainly no part of the nativity set that goes with that in anybody's home living room display. But it's an important part of the story, one, because once there's this threat raise, and once, you know, sort of power-mad Herod decides to start getting violent, how will the Messiah be saved? How will this young child who's so important that angels mm-hmm. show up, how will his life be protected? Well, his family becomes refugees. They go to Egypt to save their lives. And again, echoing when the people of Israel, when it's a large extended family of Jacob and his sons mm-hmm. and their families, go to Egypt to avoid the famine. They live there as aliens, as immigrants for a while. And in this case, Jesus and his family are refugees avoiding their own king trying to kill them. So, you know, there's no other good word to describe somebody fleeing your home country because of threat of official government violence except a refugee. Mm-hmm. So that's what they are. And for 2 years, it seems, or at least 2 years, the Magi appear. Jesus is a toddler and then spends some time, we don't know how long, in Egypt. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me, too, I never thought about this, that back in the story of Israel going down to Egypt, the one who has all these dreams where God communicates is Joseph. And now here it's Joseph getting, it's a different Joseph.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like, here's this other weird connection of, oh, it's a Joseph who's got the dreams that where God speaks. But then, as you say, there comes a point when an angel shows up in a dream and they know it's safe to go back to Nazareth. And then Matthew, who's great about quoting Old Testament prophets and saying, "See, I told you so," Matthew says, "This was to fulfill what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, quote, 'Out of Egypt I've called my son.'" Okay, well, that sounds like he's saying some Old Testament prophet is imagining that God's going to call a son out of Egypt. What's originally going on in that prophet passage?
Well, okay. I think what's going on there is that he's talking about Israel.
Okay, yeah, this is not so
much
Hosea.
Yeah, it's not so much about the Messiah as it is about the people of Israel and the fact that yes, they are literally called out of Egypt,
right?
And Jesus is supposed to be an example of how the people of Israel were to live.
Yeah,
you know, clearly the people of Israel, they mess up a lot.
Sure, like any of
Any of us. And so Jesus is the example of how they were to live.
Yeah.
And we see this over and over in his life in different aspects. You know, when he goes into the wilderness for 40 days, it's, you know, again, a throwback to the 40 years
right.
the Israelites lived in the wilderness.
So Jesus is sort of the embodiment of all that Israel was meant to be.
Yes.
And so when Hosea the prophet, centuries before any of this Jesus mm-hmm. business, says in one of his poems or oracles, "When Israel was a child, I called him, and out of Egypt I called my son," it's God sort of retelling the story of Israel comes up out of Egypt and then mm-hmm. Becomes a nation. And now Matthew, again, Matthew's not stupid. He knows that background.
Yeah.
And so it's not like he's pulling something out of context, but he's trying to say Jesus while it's fair to call him God's son, that's a whole other conversation. Here, it's Jesus is meant to be what Israel was, and Israel is God's son in this sort of symbolic way. That's often the way the relationship between God and Israel is described. And again, this is part of the beauty of the poetry that is our scriptures, that the metaphors aren't like ironclad. Sometimes the relationship between God and Israel is like a parent and a child, and sometimes it's like married couple, you know, and God says things like, you were unfaithful and you left me and I was still faithful to you. But sometimes it's like a parent-child relationship. So here, God says of his people Israel, out of Egypt I called my son. And now Matthew goes, and this Jesus is the embodiment of all that Israel was meant to be. He's God's son in another sense, true. We'll get there. But here, this is an Israel moment.
Yeah, and I mean, Matthew, and we've talked about this in previous episodes, Matthew is Jewish. He's writing to a Jewish audience. And so that's why we see all these parallels coming up in his gospel.
Yeah.
But something interesting for Matthew being a Jewish writer and writing to a Jewish audience, you know, we started off by saying, you know, well, let's read the Matthew nativity story.
Right.
All it is, you know, all that Matthew lists of the actual nativity story is that she bore him a son and named him Jesus.
Yeah.
And then we immediately jump into these three wise men.
Yeah.
Who are not Jewish.
Yeah, like, let's spend a minute talking about who these characters are, because maybe, to be honest, even calling them wise men is a little bit of a euphemism. The Greek word that's there in the original text is magi, not terribly helpful because nobody knows what a magi is, or the singular would be magus, except you probably can get a hint in there from the sound of the word that it comes from the same root that we get our word magic from. So this is closer to magicians came and visited Jesus, but not like... This is not like Siegfried and Roy. This is not like, you know, David Copperfield. This isn't like any of those illusionist kind of things. But these are people who would have practiced what we would now today call astrology or magic or things, you know, that sort of thing. And again, like, this isn't the right religious group. These are not the respectable religious people from a Jewish perspective.
No. Last week we talked about the shepherds and how the shepherds are kind of like the lowly and the outcasts, and we wouldn't expect God to come and show up to them. And here we have a group of people, at least the shepherds were Jewish.
Right.
At least they're the right religion, they're the right faith, they're the right people group.
They're in-group people, at least that way.
Yes.
Right?
But now we have a completely out-of-group, you know, totally different crew that sees the star through their practice of astrology, and they have studied texts from various religions. Who knows exactly what their faith basis is. And yet God speaks with them as well and calls them, which I just think is so interesting that we find this in Matthew's gospel.
Yeah. Yeah, because you might not expect that, because Matthew so often is interested in what does Jesus mean for Israel? What does Jesus mean for good, faithful Jews like me? And you can tell that. I mean, if you're wondering where we get that notion from, I mean, part of it, way, way back, if you've been a long time Crazy Faith Talk listener, to the first time Eric and I did... weird Bible stories. We talk about Matthew's genealogy and how he is really, really interested in tracing the lineage in the family of Israel, and only goes back to up to Abraham, doesn't go back to Adam or anything. I mean, like, he just stays in the family line in Israel for his, and he's also Matthew's especially the one of the four Gospels we have in our New Testaments who will take time to say, this was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet, and then he'll give a quotation. When Luke doesn't do that as much, it's not that he doesn't care, but he doesn't think his audience will be as familiar, right? This is an era when people don't automatically have smartphones they can Google the Old Testament on. People don't have their own personal Bibles, for that matter. So the only people who would know these scriptures by heart are people who've grown up reciting them and learning them all their lives, going to synagogue. So it tells us something about the audience for whom Matthew is writing. And there's other things that Matthew doesn't explain that, say, Mark or Luke will explain, because Matthew assumes his audience knows because he knows. Whereas Luke will take time to go, oh, well, see, here's the thing about the Pharisees. They wash their, you know, they wash their hands or they wash it. But Matthew just goes, well, of course, they're, you know, he just assumes his audience knows some things that a Jewish audience would know. So if that's part of the background, all the more powerful, all the more surprising that Matthew's on beating the drum of, here are these outsiders who God led to come find the child, and that Matthew seems to be comfortable saying God led them there. I mean, like, a star in the sky is, again, evidence of this is God's motion, right? When angels show up, it's a sign God's there. When stars show up, it's a sign God's moving the narrative forward, and that God is the one widening the reach where the Messiah's embrace goes.
Yeah, and I think... you know, we see this not only at the beginning of Matthew's gospel, but we see it at the end with the Great Commission.
Right.
You know, and Jesus telling the disciples to go out into all the world and share the good news. So while Matthew is writing to a Jewish audience, with a Jewish audience in mind and that mindset, he's making them very aware, just from the very beginnings, that yes, this message is for you first, but it is also for the entire world.
So there's this notion of keeping the promises made to Israel, the sort of faithfulness to fulfill the old covenants. The old promises don't get thrown away. And yet, the promise is, and it really in a sense always has been, about the whole world. So that even when you harp on what are the promises God made to Abraham, even those promises themselves, go back and read Genesis, this will be something that through you, Abraham, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Mm-hmm. And that at different moments in the biblical narrative, people have thought like that's an either or. Either Jesus, either God is working for all people, or it's God's going to be faithful to the people of Israel. And if you go back to the original promises, it's always been both. It's been Abraham, mm-hmm. will be through your family, but through your family, all the world, all the families of the earth will be blessed. That all along, God's had that kind of view in mind. And sometimes in the playing out of that, we pit those against one another. It's either you got to stand with God's promises to Israel is what matters, or it's about God cares about all people, mm-hmm. and that's a false dichotomy. It's a false choice. It's ultimately God's about both.
Oh, absolutely. It makes me think of, you know, how so often we hear God of the Old Testament is this mean, angry, vengeful
right.
God, and the God of the New Testament is loving and kind.
Right.
No, they're the same God.
Right.
It's the same story the whole way through. It's God loves from Genesis 1 to the end of Revelation,
yeah.
and God has come for all people from Genesis 1 to
yeah.
the end of Revelation.
Yeah, and that it's certainly true that there's this period in the narrative through which God says, I'm going to do it in this crazy, unexpected way through this family of the descendants of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and yet that's never meant to be the end point, but always meant to be a vessel through which all people then are drawn in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really important piece that is there waiting for us to see in the text itself. But again, sometimes we gloss over this, or we just miss all that's going on in the story. Yeah. Now it also seems to me, since we're calling this out, that these magi are astrologers, and again, what exactly those qualifications you had, you know, you had to go to magi school or something like that, or just have a placemat from a Chinese restaurant with the Chinese zodiac on it, or Zoroastrianism 101 or whatever. Whatever qualified them to be magi, there's no indication in the story that they're kings. There's no indication necessarily that they're even wise, like you'd want to counsel them on real estate investment advice or something, but their area of expertise is that these are people who think they can determine the events by looking at the stars or celestial objects. And so to speak their language, God speaks through a star. And so again, we have, without guessing about what this object was in the night sky, that any observer in the first century would have just called a star, whether it's an asteroid or a comet or a supernova or a who knows, whatever it is that they saw, God speaks their language. God, there's this old line of John Calvin's, and even though neither of us are out of the John Calvin family tree, there's a line of Calvin's that sticks with me, that something like that God lisps according to our weak measure, and that when God communicates, mm-hmm. the idea is that God uses baby talk, or that, you know, like, mm-hmm. and that to speak to humans, God has to speak using human limitations. And we've talked before, even the translation issue in any mm-hmm. given story, there's an issue in how do you bring something into a new language, that anytime God communicates with human beings, there's a certain amount of condescension, a certain amount of sort of baby talk going on, or a certain amount of how do I put it in language or in words that my audience will understand. And if we get that, you know, when we're talking to children, how do you explain big ideas to kids, or how do you talk to somebody in a foreign language or bridge the cultural divide, talk about the, you know, the infinite abyss between God and human beings as far as the learning curve there. So, you know, instead of God saying, well, I don't dabble in astrology, I won't know, I want to reach these people, so I'll speak using the language that they understand. I'll speak using, if this is the way to reach them, I'll speak using a star, and I'll draw them to this Jesus. And that's exactly how the story goes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, this is not the first time this happens. You know, mm-hmm. throughout all of Scripture, we see ways that God interacts with the culture that's going around, with the people. We've talked, I think, in a previous episode about Abraham and the covenant that God made with him. Again, if you've been a long-time listener, this goes back to our weird Bible story, you know, and how God used that as well to be able to speak to Abraham exactly what's going on. And I think that's part of the beauty of who God is. It's how rather than trying to force us to figure him out on his terms, God is willing to come to us on our terms and say, you know what? Okay, I want this message to be for all the world. I want these men, however many there are, we often say three, but maybe there was more, you know, to come and to see this infant and to tell the Jewish people, like, this is a gift for the whole world.
Yeah.
I'm going to use what they know.
Yeah.
I'm going to use what they follow, what they believe, to show them that there is something greater out there than what they have believed in, what they've put their faith in all this time.
Yeah, and that's such an important point, in that, like, God doesn't wait for them to get their religion right and then say, and now you're allowed to come see Jesus. That clearly, these are people continuing to practice their faith in astrology because they follow a star to get there. It's not like wherever they are from, Persia or wherever else, it's not like they find some tract that says, welcome to Judaism, they convert and say, now let's go find the Messiah. They're watching the night sky, doing their astrology thing, and they're convinced that the stars that they think dictate human events have led them to something important is happening in Palestine. Go there and find out what it is. Mm-hmm. And that's the means God uses. So instead of God waiting around for them to get it figured out right, God meets them sort of on their terms and brings them to come to see Jesus.
Now my question, and again, like I asked last week, you know, Steve, and who knows, you're more the scholar than I am. What do they do with this once they see the baby? You know?
Yeah.
Like we asked last week about, you know, how people were to react to the shepherds when they hear this news coming from them. What do the wise men do when they go home from this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic question. And I guess the first thing that sparks in my mind as a little bit of a digression is, I think it says something about the character of the Gospels that we have, that Matthew doesn't speculate about that. You know, like, that instead of, as much as I might want to know the burning story of, man, what's it like when you come back home after a trip like this? How do you explain to your family where you've been for years? And how do you explain to your family what you saw and why it mattered? That Matthew doesn't say, and now when they got home, here's what happened. It says to me, at the very least, that Matthew isn't making stuff up out of whole cloth. I mean, the gospel writers aren't just inventing stories because they want to find a good story to tell. And I think that's an important thing for the way we Christians think about and talk about our scriptures. That there's history, there are certainly parables that are not historical stories in the Bible. There's poems, there's songs, there's hymns, there's things like that. But when the biblical writers say, this is how it happened, this is what I was, and these are the stories, that's something that's important, that at least as they're telling it to us, they're convinced that God really enters human history, and that there's something reliable about that this is the kind of person Jesus is and was, rather than, oh man, I think we really ought to have a story about what happens to the magic at home. Let me make that story up.
Yeah.
And that the early church did a lot of thoughtful, intentional work wrestling with what stories they thought were a part of our normative. These are the stories that will shape us and these ones won't. Because there are stories out there that writers wrote in the first, say, 2-3 centuries, and gospel accounts of Jesus that aren't in our Bibles. That could be a whole conversation on another day. But one of the things that you notice if you spent any time with, say, the infancy gospel, there are infancy gospels out there that are like stories about Jesus as a child, is that sometimes they have a really, really like fairy tale like quality. Like there's one story in a, it might be called the infancy gospel of Thomas, where young child Jesus is making little birds out of clay and then makes them come to life. And then there's a story where some kid makes fun of Jesus and he curses the kid dead. And that, like, these are stories that have a totally different feel than what we get in the actual Gospels. That, man, wouldn't it be fun to have a story of young child Jesus? But the fact that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John don't give those to us says something like that they had editorial restraint. That they didn't just say, man, I heard this really cool story about Jesus making clay pigeons come to life. Let me toss that in because it sounds cool. But there's this, nope, I don't have reason to believe that happened. That the fact we don't have stories like that about the Magi says to me something like that Matthew isn't a novelist saying, now let me pick a whole other perspective to write from. Let's imagine if I could follow the Magi all the way back home. But I mean, there that gives me some grounding in the story. But beyond that, I mean, it is an interesting question. That these people can't have been the same anymore, you know?
No, I mean, they've encountered the living God.
Mm-hmm. And yet, by all accounts, Jesus didn't walk around with a halo that, like, other than the star, like, mm-hmm. Jesus looks like a human baby because he's a human baby.
Yeah.
And that Jesus, like, isn't born talking in blesseds and these and thys and those. You know, he's a baby. So he's making baby sounds at 2 years old. He's speaking toddler speak. You know, he's mm-hmm. he's getting his subjects and verbs wrong half the time. but there, without there being a halo over him, they saw a human child, convinced it was worth it, and then go home. Mm-hmm. They were changed, and yet not changed in a way that they could demonstrably say, oh, well, I know he was the Son of God because he had a halo, or I know he was the Son of God because the clouds parted and there was light around him all the time, or he was like a Disney princess with the animals talking to him or something. There's none of this. Jesus is a human child who doesn't look different from other human children, mm-hmm. because in that important sense, he isn't any different from other. He's one of us. He's human all the way down, not just partially or somewhat or looks human. But that's where things are at for him. Yeah. But I have to think that he's changed to some degree. That the Magi are changed to some degree, and that they go back home, and that something has changed for them. It at least reminds me a little bit of there's a poem of T.S. Eliot called the Journey of the Magi, and I don't have the words right exactly, but the gist is that when they go back home, and it's actually a poem from the perspective of one of the Magi, that they go back and it's sort of like all their old lives feel dead to them. I mean, it's not a terribly happy, cheery sort of a poem in that regard, but it's like everything else, it's like going back to black and white, and there I was in color. And it feels like that the old gods, the old idols, all that oldness, it just feels like it's dead anymore, because something has changed. They've come face to face, and even if they can't put their finger on it, something important has changed for them, and they go back as changed people. It, in some ways, the Magi remind me of that story from Acts about the Ethiopian eunuch who goes off on his way back home. And again, he's going the wrong way. It's not like he's going back to Jerusalem where he's going to hang out and join the church there. He has this encounter. He comes face to face with one of Jesus' followers. He's baptized. He comes to faith in Jesus. And then he keeps going on his way home. And we never hear from him again. The Magi are like that in that list of characters of people who sort of are scattered. And then we don't hear from them again. And that the gospel writers are content to leave it at that. But just with sort of this like ellipsis, the sort of dot, dot, dot of, and who knows where their adventure went from there.
Yeah. You know, I appreciate that the gospel writers don't try to make up stories about these kind of things. But as somebody who likes detail, somebody who likes a nice, clear ending to stories, it also frustrates me as well. And who knows, maybe someday when we get to heaven, I'll get to talk to one of the wise men and see, okay, well, so what did happen? Maybe, you know, I'll get to talk to the Ethiopian eunuch. Okay, so what happened with the rest of your life?
And one of the things, I mean, without getting too sentimental or speculative about what glory will be like, I do think that the Bible sets us up for this notion of that the family of God is awfully wide and diverse like that, and that there are people whose lives were lived millennia ago, and yet whose stories intersect with ours insofar as we get to hear about them, and that there will come a point at which we'll discover all these ways that our lives have been interwoven with people, some, you know, that we can see in this life, some people that we know, well, my life touched that life, or their life touched mine, but some people who half a world away, or 1,000 years interspersed, or 2,000 years, were part of the same web, part of the same family. And maybe it would have been easy for Matthew to make that claim if he were just talking about the story of Israel. If it were just sort of, well, all us Israelites are connected across time and space. But Matthew dares in the story to push further and to say it's not just even the biological family of Israel, but that this is something that reaches out to all people, even to these people who show up for one scene in the gospel and go back and are never heard from again in the course of the gospel. But there's something powerful about all those loose ends and known that even if we can't see where all those threads go, the God who has orchestrated all these things so far doesn't leave those threads loose just to go on their own, but somehow will one day get to a point of seeing them all gathered up again.
And if nothing else, you know, for me and for you as non-Jewish people, you know, people that cannot trace their lineage back to Abraham, this is just another sign of how God's message is for the entire world.
Yeah. And a reminder that the only reason you and I comfortably sitting around a table getting to talk about Jesus, the only way we get to be part of the story is that God has made this good news something that includes us as well. Mm-hmm. So rather than sort of me getting in that sort of patronizing, well, this is how God lets in those other people. Like, I'm one of the other people. I'm one of those outsiders that is graced enough to belong to be a part of this. Not because I bring credentials or pedigree or something, but because what I bring is just I'm an outsider. I'm Gentile, and God's love includes me as well. Well, we appreciate you listening and joining us here for our conversation today. We've run out of time yet again, but hopefully you can join us next time for ongoing adventures in Crazy Faith Talk. Thanks, continued Merry Christmas, and Happy Epiphany.
See you guys.